This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. That name, John Dankosky, falls into what might best be described as the traditional camp, an ethnic-sounding, often mispronounced last name, following one of the oldest, most common, most biblical, and most boring first names. Look, I don't blame my parents here. John was my grandfather's name and his oldest son's name, and it's a good, solid name. But it has tumbled in popularity over the years, in part because, well, because it's just so ordinary. I get called Dankosky or JD more often than John these days. After about 4 years old, I was never really a Johnny. Given some of the other traditional options my parents had, it's likely I would have been a Jim or a Bill, not exactly very exciting. Sometimes I wished I had a cooler, a more memorable name, something befitting my birth during the age of Aquarius, for instance. But as we'll hear today, you might not want what you wish for. Today, Where We Live, we're looking into names. Interns Kristen Dorr and Andrew Gates went to West Hartford to find out more.
If you had to rename yourself, what name would you pick and why?
I love the name Pippa. I think it's so fun.
I would keep my first name and I would add on another last name, like Love and Happiness.
Sunray.
Coming from a very strong Christian background, I think I might choose a biblical name, a name like David.
I probably wouldn't rename myself. I like my name.
I'd come up with something super mystical like Unicorn or something like that to really throw people off.
I really don't know. I don't know if there's another name that would be as fitting.
Wouldn't do it. Wouldn't do it.
Bob again, but spelled backwards.
Professor David Figlio of Northwestern University has published several studies that suggest that names may have a bigger influence on us than we think. Certainly puts a lot of pressure on parents to give their child a name that sets him or her up for the future. So is it better to stick to a traditional name or give your child a name that allows him or her to stand out from the crowd? You can call us at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive. We'd like to hear about your name, how you got it, what you named your baby, what name you wish you had. We want to bring in David Figlio, who joins us by phone. He's director of the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What first got you interested in researching the power of names?
Well, so I have three children myself. My youngest just turned 15 on Saturday, and of course, I think every parent spends a lot of time thinking about what their kids are going to be named. Jewish Talmudic tradition says that your name is your first gift from your parents. So I guess going through it three times with my spouse, we were thinking about that. From an academic perspective, the reason I started thinking about names is that I had done a lot of research on teacher expectations, and I found that teachers who expect more from children tend to get higher results, especially from kids coming from disadvantaged backgrounds. And I was in talking to lots of teachers and asking them, how do you form expectations about kids? And one thing that came up over and over and over again is, you say, when I have a kid whose name sounds like X or who's dressed a certain way or something like that, I can't help but start thinking, do they not have a certain type of home support, for example? So I really wanted to start studying that scientifically.
So let's start there, because you've done a number of studies about this. Let's start with that study where you actually look at how teachers treat students with uncommon names. What did you find out?
Well, so it's not necessarily uncommon names. So just thinking about your introduction for a moment, it's really about names that sound like they have relatively high or relatively low social status. And by that I mean, are they names that sound like they're given by college graduates, or are they names that sound like they're given by high school dropouts? And that's true for both relatively common names and relatively uncommon names. What I found is that teachers tend to think more highly of children who have names that tend to be given by better educated parents. And teachers tend to think less highly of children who have names that sound like they're given by less educated parents. And one thing that is the case is this is true across races. So we have relatively high status names typically given by white families, and relatively high and low status names given by black families and by Latino families, and so on. It's really about the status rather than racial identifiability that seems to make a difference.
So this is about the teachers taking a look and saying, this is the sort of parent, really, who gives support at home versus this is the sort of parent who maybe doesn't give as much support at home. If a parent, say, gives an uncommon name, but it is a literary reference, that teacher might feel differently than if someone has just, you know, literally made up a name from scratch.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is even the made-up names from scratch, there are certain tells, and this is hard to do on the radio, but there are certain tells that are subconscious because relatively educated parents and relatively uneducated parents tend to gravitate towards different sounds and different letters. And I am not saying that teachers are saying, oh, that kid has an X in the middle of his name, so mom must be a high school dropout or something like that. But I am saying that when a teacher sees a list of names, teachers are actually relatively good at predicting, does this kid come from an educated versus less educated background, partially on the basis of the name.
We're talking with David Figlio, director of the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. He's been studying names and how they influence us. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We'd like to hear how you decided to name your child or children. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Canton. Hi there, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. My wife and I named our son Apollo after my wife's interest in Greek mythology and my interest in the history of the Apollo space program. What makes it a little interesting is that my wife has Irish heritage, and I come from Lithuanian heritage. So he's the only red-headed, blue-eyed Apollo I know.
So now that you've done this, do you have any second thoughts? Do you think it's a strong name? Do you think it suits your son, Michael?
He's living up to the name for sure. My hair is getting grayer by the day. One other interesting thing was this past June, Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut, was in Connecticut on a book tour, and we were able to go, and Apollo met Buzz Aldrin and shook his hand. So he met the second man who walked on the moon.
And Apollo astronaut with a great name like Buzz. Thank you so much, Michael, for sharing that story. Of course, growing up when I think of Apollo Creed, the boxer who lost to Rocky, but that's a different story. So what do you think about this idea, David? Someone has something that means something to them, and they decide to name their child that. Does that set up in any way, shape, or form how Apollo is going to do in life?
Well, you know, I'm so glad that we had that as our first caller. Thanks, Mike. The first thing that I really want to tell your listeners is that it's really important to give your child a name that you love, that's meaningful to you. That's by far the most important thing, more than any other type of thing. Now, I don't have my naming algorithm in front of me. It's an hour earlier here. I'm sitting on my couch at home talking to you, so I can't go and run the numbers on Apollo. But my strong suspicion is that Apollo is going to come out pretty high up there in terms of some type of a status. I mean, it's mythology is very literary. For example, there are all these different types of potential meanings there. Tends to be very favorable associations. So my hunch is, from the teacher perspective, Apollo is going to be treated quite well, and as Mike pointed out, it offers this interesting, nice entree into a different world. Of course, astronauts are going to be drawn to that, and that's going to provide neat opportunities. So this is a great example of a way in which a relatively uncommon name can possibly open some doors for a person. Now, I'm not the type of person to say that Apollo is going to be predestined to a certain type of thing. There is a lot of research out there that says that people named Dennis, for example, are more likely to become dentists. But that type of research tends to be cherry-picking because the things you think about, people named Lewis are more likely to move to St. Louis, but they're not more likely to move to Louisville, for example. So I have no idea if Apollo is going to be an astronaut, but I do think that Apollo is going to be treated better by his teachers.
Well, okay, so Apollo is a name that you think, you haven't run the numbers, but you think maybe has a higher status. Let's just get this out of the way. We talked about this in the opening of our show at the top, this controversy over the young man named Messiah. So there's a name that has maybe some of the same connotations as Apollo. You're naming him after a god, but Messiah seems to fit into, I don't know, a different camp, David.
So religious names in general are real wild cards because when we start thinking about religious names, I mean, religion is something that cuts across all social statuses. So, of course, as soon as you have a child named Messiah, that's going to potentially raise some eyebrows in certain circumstances. Although it's kind of interesting to think about. There's a child of a good friend of mine named Salvador, for example. That's essentially the same thing, but in Spanish, for example. I know many Mexican children named Jesus, many, many more named Maria, of course, many, many people from Northern European or English background named Mary. So in some regards, I think the thing that's really interesting about the Messiah story is actually just the way that particular judge chose to react to the name Messiah. I personally have a very difficult time believing that people are going to, that many people are going to react one way or another to that name per se, just because we see those same very similar types of names all the time in our culture.
I want to get to a few more phone calls. Nadina is calling from Hamden. Hello there, Nadina. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I was calling because I like my name, but it's a unique name, and I had difficulty with it all my life because people always had difficulty spelling my name, pronouncing my name. So when I named my son, I named him Christopher because I wanted something that was going to be, you know, just easy for people to understand, easy for people to spell, and was just kind of like a, I guess, a common-sounding name.
I read here, Nadina, are you a teacher? Is that right?
I am a teacher, yes.
So now, do you buy into what David Figlio has done research on, that indeed teachers see a student of a certain name and go, oh, boy, that's trouble, or maybe prejudge someone based on the name?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. When I heard him say that, you know, that he was the head of this department at Northwestern, I said, well, maybe he does have some background in it. But when I first heard that, I thought that that was ridiculous, to be honest. Like, no offense. But as a teacher, I have never, at least consciously, thought a certain way about a student because of their name. But when I named my child Christopher, or when I was going through names, I needed to make sure that I didn't name him something that I associated with, like, a negative experience that I had with a student.
Very, very interesting. Well, and Nadina, I think, puts a pretty fine point on it there, David. So on the face of it, this teacher thinks, this research doesn't mean anything. But here she is naming her own child in part because of her own experiences.
Well, you know, it is kind of interesting. And Nadina, thanks for the call. One thing that's really a very important thing that Nadina points out, which is the reason that it's so important to study this type of thing scientifically, is that one's mileage may vary. So for every person who has an uncommon name and says, gosh, this caused me all these problems, I want to have a relatively common name for my child, there's another person who says, boy, I'm so glad my parents named me this uncommon name. And frankly, it's the same thing with teachers. So what I did when I was studying this, for example, is I start out with, I'm a big data empirical researcher. So I started out with a set of focus groups and interviews, and I interviewed about 200 teachers about various different things regarding teacher expectations. And I would say that in 15 to 20 cases out of those 200, a teacher explicitly pointed out things about a child's name and saying when they're thinking about forming expectations. So that was enough to get me thinking, huh. So then we start looking about ways to formalize this. And so then the way in which scientific research gets done is because you don't go and ask people what they think. You look at what they do. Mm. And so I took the entire set of all the teachers and all the children in one of the largest school districts in the United States. And as I ran the numbers, I compared two brothers or two sisters, one with a relatively high status name, one with a comparatively low status name, and just watched and saw how did teachers treat these kids.
Wow.
And the kid with the relatively high status name was more likely to be recommended for gifted programs. And the brother or sister, same parents, same background, same socioeconomic status, just happened to have a lower status name, was more likely to be called learning disabled. And I watched them. I didn't personally watch them. I looked at their data.
Yeah.
But over time, I saw that the two kids diverged in their performance in school. So it was like Pygmalion in the classroom. So, Nadina, it would be wonderful if you don't prejudge kids based on a name. But on the other hand, it looks like a lot of your peers do.
I want to get to some tweets here. Steven writes us, he named his son Calvin. I can't front. Calvin is sort of named after his cartoon namesake. And at 2.5 years old, it's becoming clear we nailed it. A Facebook comment here from Lonnie who says, we named our son Zephyr, which means west wind. He's definitely living up to his name as a very spirited 21-month-old. A quick call here from Maria in Ashford. Hi, Maria. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
My full name is Maria Magdalena. And I am happy with my name. And as your guest says, in the Latino community, there are hundreds of Salvadores and Jesuses, Jesus. And no one says nothing and no one's scared. And my grandson was named Diego. And he's the only one in the whole school that his name is Diego. Because my daughter admired Diego Rivera.
Mm.
So that's my point.
Well, Maria, before I let you go, I'm wondering if you can talk about the Magdalena part of your name.
Well, Maria Magdalena. First, my mother was Maria, and Maria Magdalena was the one that was a companion of Jesus. So it's a biblical name.
It is a biblical name, and it's a beautiful name, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Let me tell you something.
Yes.
Since I moved to this country about 30-something years ago, I lost Magdalena, because in here everybody goes with the first name. So it's been 30 years that I don't hear my full name, just Maria.
That's the way we tend to do it in the United States, but I love Maria Magdalena. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for taking my call.
We have so many more people who want to join our conversation. I quickly just want to ask you one last question, David. One of the other studies you did is something that we wanted to get to, this idea of a feminine boy's name. So a boy with a feminine name might have different results than someone with a very masculine sounding name, like, say, I don't know, David or John. What did you find?
Well, I found that boys with names that now are typically given to girls, frankly, that's a place where they do seem to have problems. So you have a boy named Ashley or Shannon or Courtney or Jamie, for example. Of course, I have friends with a lot of those names, male friends who are doing great. But here's what seems to happen. Around middle school, the boys with names that are typically now given to girls in this country tend to kind of go off the deep end. They get into much more trouble in school, their performance in school tanks, and they actually tend to bring down their whole classroom. And that's especially the case when there's a girl in the same class with that same name. So if you have a boy named Jamie and there's a girl named Jamie in the same classroom, everybody's performance seems to do a lot worse.
David Figlio is director of the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. He's done a lot of research into names. And thank you so much for joining us, David. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure to be here.
Of course, one of the early researchers into this was one Johnny Cash. We'll listen to a bit of his famous song about this subject. And we'll be back with more names coming up right after this, Where We Live.
And he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.
This is Where We Live.
What is your name, and do you know why your parents gave you that name?
My name is Sulinette Morales. My name was given to me because my mother wanted to come up with a unique name, and boy, did she do a good job of that.
My name is Bernard Ansa, originally from Ghana.
My name is Menelik, and I had a ceremony around my name. My father, a spirit came to him and said that my name is supposed to be Menelik. And Menelik was a king in Ethiopia.
My name is Molly, and I was named after that because of my grandmother, who was my best friend.
My name is Ray, and it's because my father's name was Ray.
My great-grandmother was from Sweden, and she immigrated to the U.S. My mom really loved her, and she died before I was born, so she wanted to name me Elsa.
My name is Solveig. It's another Swedish name.
Stephanie, my mother heard someone else by the same name on a beach while she was pregnant with me and decided she liked the name.
My name's Carolyn Margaret. My middle name is Margaret because my mother's aunt had my birthday.
It's Robert. I think my mother selected it because she had a doll named Robert.
Those are some voices gathered by interns Kristen Dorr and Andrew Gates. We're talking about names today on the show. Good names, bad names, how they contribute to our identity. We want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. There's been a surprising amount of academic study about names, which we've been talking about. Now we want to welcome in Dr. Donna Lillian, who's director of the American Names Society, as well as an associate professor at Appalachian State University. Dr. Lillian, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
I also want to welcome in Laura Wattenberg, who's creator of Baby Name Wizard and the author of The Baby Name Wizard. Laura, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Good morning, John.
First of all, Donna Lillian, I asked our first guest about this. Why did you get so interested in names? I'm fascinated by this, but people are really into names. What got you into it?
Well, when I was a graduate student in the 1980s, I was studying women's surname choices. And when I started researching it, I realized that there was a whole lot of study going on about names, and I was very interested in that and interested in the political implications. So I started doing studies of that, and 30 years later, 35 years later, I'm still doing it.
Well, so we talked with our first guest about some of the impact that people's names actually have on them later in life. Do you put a whole lot of stock into this? Do you think that the names that parents give their children can tell us something about who they're going to become as people?
Well, I don't think it determines absolutely. I think there's a lot of factors that go into it, but there have been a number of studies which do suggest that it can be an influence on how people respond to somebody and how they present themselves in the world.
Laura Wattenberg, what do you think about this? Do you put some stock in these studies? Do you think that names really matter as far as who we become later in life?
I think there is increasing evidence that at least on a subtle level, names can shape the way people react to you. And I think that's actually an important issue today because we've had a revolution in name style. Name style has fractured across the country. You see different groups of people naming much differently today and judging each other more based on that.
Tell us more about those fractures. What do you see? What are some examples of this?
Well, 50, 60 years ago, the typical American baby received a name that was very broadly used, very much agreed upon, like a Paula or a Gregory. Today, the statistically typical average American baby gets a name like Paisley or Giovanni, which might be common in her community, but completely outlandish in another part of the country.
I'm wondering if you're seeing some of these same trends, Dr. Lillian.
Well, my studies, my own individual studies are mostly on surnames. But yes, what I think is in part that different ethnic groups and regional groups are identifying themselves with different naming patterns. And that can be very positive as a way of developing a group identity and a cultural identity. But then, yes, when you cross over into another group, they may not understand it in the same way.
I want to get to some phone calls because a lot of people want to join our conversation. Barbara is in New Haven. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. This is Barbara.
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, thanks. I have two little anecdotes. My son, who's, my firstborn, we had a huge discussion on what name to name him. And I come from Israel, and my husband is from the States. And we wanted a name that would sound the same in Hebrew, and it would work there, and it would work here. So amazingly enough, we came up with Ben, which sounds exactly the same in both, which worked wonderful and, suits him to a T. But my the most amazing thing was my second pregnancy was actually twins. And I had a dream before we had picked some names, but I had a dream before they were born. And I basically just dreamed that one was going to be named, you know, Katie, and the other one was going to name Sarah. And I made sure that to tell the doctor to tell me exactly who was coming out first so that I wouldn't mix them up because basically, you know, they had to have this name. And if by any chance he mixed them up, it would be horrible. And Sarah, you know, came out second, and she's the stronger personality. And, you know, she's black or white. And Katie, who had the, you know, nicer, gentler name, came out first. And it's amazing how just, you know, from this dream I had, I got two names that basically fit them perfectly.
That's so interesting. Barbara, thank you so much for sharing that. And quickly, I just wanted to go to you, Laura Wattenberg, about the popularity of the biblical name these days. You know, obviously, this used to be a much more popular thing back in the day, but there are still a lot of biblical names that people name their kids all the time.
We still see biblical names. They're actually at an all-time historic low if you look across all names from the Bible. But the biggest shift has been away from the classic Christian biblical names, the John and Marys, and toward names of the Old Testament that might not have been considered mainstream for Christians 100 years ago. Because we're so focused on style today, parents are really determined for their kids to have a name that sounds distinctive and fresh and helps them stand out.
I want to get to Adrian, who's calling from East Haven. Hello, Adrian. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, this is Adrian.
Adrian, I apologize. I want to get your name right.
Yes, that's one of the problems with my name. Growing up, no one could pronounce it. No one could spell it. I never had a nickname except for a very embarrassing one from my father, which I shan't repeat. But I never had a nickname growing up. So when I became an adult, when I went away to college, my friends actually helped me create a new nickname for myself, which is Addie, which is what I go by now. But everybody from my old life still calls me Adrienne, and everyone from my new life calls me Addie.
Adrienne, thank you very much for sharing that story. This idea of having a nickname is always, of course, a difficult thing. You can't really make your own nicknames. You have to have someone give them to you. I learned that on Seinfeld. Anessa is calling from Canterbury. Hi, Anessa. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Oh, I've just been listening to your show, and it's ironic because I've been thinking about my daughter and her name and how I regret that I didn't stick with my choice at her birth. Which was Odessa. My husband, my late husband, and I had planned her name. He was a very historical person. He liked history, I should say. And we chose Odessa for a voyage. And I was giving birth, and my mother-in-law begged me, and she kept begging me, please don't name her Odessa. It doesn't sound white enough. So I actually became so stressed out. I never named her Odessa. I named her Serena. My mother named her last second, Serena. So I thought that was acceptable. She is serene, but I would like to have her be, you know, a serene journey.
If I could just ask you about this, it doesn't sound white enough? She actually said this to you?
It was, yeah, that's what she said to me. My name is Anessa, so Odessa sounds similar to Anessa.
And interesting, she ends up with the same name as one of the most famous African-American tennis players in the world.
Isn't that so?
It's kind of amazing, isn't it? Anessa, thank you so much for that story. You have a beautiful name as well. Thank you for your phone call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to take some more phone calls in just a moment at 860-275-7266 as we talk about names, and we'll get to some naming trends. But I want to ask Dr. Donna Lillian a bit about surnames and some of these trends that you've been studying over the years. Of course, we've gotten a few phone calls from women, and the way women decide to take their husbands' names, the way their names actually may affect their lives moving forward. What have you learned about this and the trends over time?
Well, until about 1972, women in this country thought that they had to take their husband's surname. There had been a misinterpretation of a Supreme Court ruling back in the 19th century. But once women realized they had the legal right, some began to retain their own name. And so the practice of retaining their name was associated with the feminist movement, gained a certain amount of momentum into the 1980s, but never made a majority. What I've done studies in the 1980s, the 90s, the 2000s, and it's about steady for women over 30, but there's a trend back towards younger women, women currently in their 20s, to take their husband's surname. The association, I find it fascinating. People talk about their name and their identity, and their surname matters to them, and it's about their family identity, and yet men expect women to give that up, and women grow up expecting to give up that part of their identity. So, you know, I even my nephew is getting married in September, and the wedding invitation didn't say you are invited to the marriage of. It said you are invited, or, you know, Jessica will give up her surname to Matthew. That was how the wedding invitation was framed.
Oh, that's interesting.
I thought that was fascinating. Yeah, so they're going to be in every paper I write from now on. But, you know, so it's associated, you know, the surname is associated very tightly with the identity of a man and of a family unit, but the woman is expected to give that up. So, I always ask the question, well, what does that say about your identity as a woman?
Of course, one of the things that we haven't really gotten into, though, that is important is your family name that is your second name is sometimes traced to your ethnicity. It's sometimes traced to something very specific to your family. When you change names, sometimes there can be a clash. I've certainly heard of women, doctor, who will not change the names because their first name just wouldn't go at all with their husband's last name.
Yes. Yeah. Some people choose based on aesthetic grounds, that their own surname goes better with their first name, or some, you know, have a surname that people find difficult to pronounce in this country. So for aesthetic reasons or for simplicity, they'll take their husband's surname. You know, supposing they have a 10-syllable surname and their husband has a 2-syllable, they're often quite relieved to get a short name that people can pronounce and spell.
We're going to get some more phone calls at 860-275-7266 here. Let's go to, I think it's Ed Lira, who's calling from Stanford. I want to make sure I get your name right. Ed Lira, you're on Where We Live.
Yes. Hello, good morning. Great show. I am very grateful that you got my call. I'm originally from Albania and came to this country 15 years ago. And my name is Ed Lira. And my brother actually gave my name and to my older sister. And I come from a big family, and my parents were not allowed to give religious names because of communism. We were not allowed to practice religion or give any religion name. Many people did at the time. So Adira was a popular name in 1976. And the reason, my name, the meaning is because a big writer wrote a poem about the language, Albanian language, and it says, our language is so good, it's so pure, it's so Adira. And everybody tried to use that, because 500 years ago, the Ottoman Empire tried to tell everyone, you need to change your name or we will go take your life. I mean, take your wife or kill your family, because they wanted everybody to become, to change their religion as well. And many people, they just changed the name so they could survive the time. And it's amazing how life in the last 10 years has been for me. And I was able to keep my Adira, but as a child, I was called Lila, L-I-L-A, as a nickname. Yeah. And I have been 7 years that I haven't been able to go back home, and last year I started feeling homesick, and I started using it. When I was called to look for a house, people would say to me, oh, what's your name? And they had a hard time spelling, so I would say Lila, and it kind of felt good. And this year I changed it, and I put it as my middle name because of the...
What I want to do is, and thank you so much for your phone call. It brings up something that I know that I want to get to Laura about. You know, she's telling a story there that happens a lot of places where there are many countries around the world in the past and even present where you can't name your children certain things. What do you know about this, Laura?
Absolutely. We take baby naming freedom for granted in the United States, but I think that actually says something about us, too. Typically, name regulations reflect something about the value of the country. In her case, in Albania, you saw communist restrictions that prevented religious naming. In other countries, religious naming has been mandated. You have to choose a name from the roster of saints. We see even today countries like Iceland and Portugal requiring that you use a name in their language as kind of a cultural preservation against the press of globalization. And in Northern Europe, where they have such a strong social welfare system, names are part of that social welfare effort. They take pains to keep kids from having names that they think will cause them harm.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of trends do you see here in Connecticut? Does Connecticut have any sort of a naming style guide?
Every part of America today has a naming style guide. Mm-hmm. In the most recent edition of the Baby Name Wizard, I actually have a map of the regional name styles because it differs so much. Connecticut is a traditional name ground, but leaning toward the romantic. So you have a lot of the sort of classic ladylike names like Caroline and Charlotte, as well as the kind of Shakespearean Italian names like Juliana and Adriana. We want to be traditional, but we don't want to be boring.
Huh. Traditional, but not boring. Okay. I'm going to get to a few more phone calls here quickly. Dee Dee's calling from New Haven. Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I heard you say a few minutes ago that people really don't give themselves nicknames. I was born Diana, and when I was about two, I started calling myself Dee Dee just because, and I convinced everybody, all the adults around me, to call me that too, and I'm still Dee Dee. I've never gone by Diana since then.
I love that story. Thank you. And what I was alluding to is a Seinfeld episode in which it says, you're not supposed to choose your own nickname, but I think that's more for adults. I think when you're a child, you should probably be able to alter your name however you like. Thank you very much for that. Somebody else tweeted us, who is a Diana, who says, I like my name. My then 7-year-old sister named me after Wonder Woman and Princess Di, which I find pretty cool. One last thing I want to get to you with, Laura, is this idea of naming after somebody in popular culture. I mean, I'm sure that we saw an awful lot of Dianas around Princess Di, and we can go through the list of people who are popular for a time, and then we see many, many babies named that. Is this a trend that has continued? Are people still naming their children after famous people in the news today?
You definitely see baby names over time as a kind of fossil record of our culture. You can tell what people are thinking about. But despite the media-drenched society today, in fact, we're less likely to name after celebrities than we were in the past. If you look back to a Judy Garland or a Shirley Temple or even political leaders and military leaders of the past, parents were much more willing to admire people and name after them. Today, if you name after a celebrity, really you're just choosing the style. We're not ready to commit, certainly not to our presidential names.
I want to thank our guest, Laura Wattenberg, is creator of Baby Name Wizard and author of The Baby Name Wizard. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Donna Lillian, who's president of the American Names Society, thank you so much for being here.
It's been fun. Thanks very much.
I want to read one more email when we head into break here. Alicia says, I was aiming for unique when we named our son Everett. I hesitated when I discovered its meaning, strong like a wild boar. I'm ultimately grateful we made this choice because he ended up in the NICU for the first 10 days of his life. He lived up to his name, proving very strong. He's vibrant, healthy, and energetic, 20 months old. Congratulations on that, Alicia. And you can keep those tweets coming. Now, when we come back, we're going to look at another baby that people name. That would be their businesses. Startup names are getting increasingly weirder and weirder. We'll find out why. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Governor Daniel Malloy will stop by our studios for his regular check-in. He hasn't officially announced that he's seeking re-election, but he is gathering new Republican opponents for that job almost weekly. We'll talk with Governor Malloy about the 2014 race, about the economy, and much more. You can join the conversation with your questions for Governor Malloy on the next Where We Live. Today, we're talking about names and the power that they have. We're going to continue this discussion with Steve Manning. He's the managing director of Igor, which is a San Francisco-based naming company. Naming businesses is just as important, sometimes more important than naming your child. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, did I pronounce it right? It's Igor, not Igor, right?
Any way you want to pronounce it.
So describe to me the process of finding a name for a startup company. How does it work?
It depends on what kind of startup company you're talking about, but if you're talking about Silicon Valley, the unfortunate part is that they've self-imposed a lack of real estate, so they're looking for the shortest .com that they're able to register, and that's really the only consideration they have in their minds.
The shortest .com, it doesn't matter if it's a nonsense word, just a very short name that is, I assume, memorable that you can put a .com after.
The problem is they're not memorable. Really, the driving concern is the shortest .com that they can register or buy for a few dollars. Everything else seems to fall to the wayside.
Well, take us through the process. As you try to help a company form a name, what do you ask them? What are you trying to get them to tell you to tease out the best possible name for a company?
First of all, we're trying to understand what they're bringing to the table and what we can define as new or different about what they're doing. But one of the most important things is to look at what all of their competitors are doing and how their competitors are naming themselves. What are their competitors? What part of the conversation are their competitors trying to own? And we're kind of looking for the unclaimed territory to find a different way to take ownership of the conversation.
When you say
something different,
when you say try something different, I think the problem a lot of people have is that they see so many companies trying something different with these unusual names, and maybe it didn't start with Google or Yahoo, but it seems to have headed in that direction. Can you really stand out from a crowd when every new company seems to have some unusual new name?
No, you can't, because they are no longer different. You know, they are status quo. They are the white noise. So if you're jumping on the latest trend in, you know, technology-based startups, you are sort of fading into the background and becoming part of the white noise. There's nothing different about, you know, this new crop of names, and they simply jump on a trend.
Well, what are some of the big naming trends right now that you're seeing?
The LY became a big one. Anything ending in LY, that's when Liberia was granted a top-level domain that ended in .ly. So people would do something like register, you know, SIMP.ly and think they became Simply, which led to the .fys that you see all over the place. As soon as one company is successful, everybody else, they don't know what the acceptable rules are for naming. So as soon as they see success, they copy it. You know, with Twitter, Flickr, Tumblr, they all dropped the last E in the name. So then everybody started doing that. And then, of course, when a company like Twitter got successful enough, they were able to buy Twitter.com. But, you know, Spotify was successful, so now everybody's doing something FY at the end of their name. But it's been true throughout history and throughout the Internet.
We're talking with Steve Manning. He's managing director of Igor. It's a California-based naming company, and you can join us at 860-275-7266 or tweet us at Where We Live. Helder tweets us, don't even get me started on startup names. The number of times I have to explain Rabbit Ears Media to people. He named his company Rabbit Ears Media. Of course, Rabbit Ears is something that you used to use on top of a television set. A lot of people don't remember that. Can people sometimes suffer from trying to be too clever, Steve, by trying to make a reference that some people might get and other people just won't get, and you have to explain yourself over and over again?
Yes. I mean, there's a difference. I mean, if the name is interesting enough so people ask you, then you've already won the battle. That means that people are thinking about your name. If the name is so obtuse that it doesn't give anybody anything to, you know, lean forward and look at, then you're in trouble. And I think when you have these made-up words or word parts that don't reference anything that we all sort of carry around in our brains, then you're in trouble. But if people are asking you about your name, that's probably a good sign.
What are the sorts of names that you think people will remember, that will stick in someone's mind and maybe make them ask that question?
It's got to be something. It's much more effective to play off of ideas that we're all carrying around than to try to jam new ones into people's brains. You know, we're really dealing with real words, plays on words, well-known phrases. Constructing, you know, something out of word parts from Latin or Greek or misspellings is just not going to be effective.
I want to get a quick phone call here from Eliza calling from East Hartford. Hi, Eliza. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. My name's Eliza, and I had a question about the thoughts on choosing a name based off of whether or not they will be profiled or how they might be profiled on a job application. I chose both my son's names, and I'm pregnant now, because I was concerned that if I chose a name that was more unique, and I appreciate people wanting to jump out of the box and get something a little bit different, but I was concerned that if I chose a name that was more unique for my sons, that somebody might look at their name on a job application later on and down the road and think something about them other than what was on the application or what was on their resume.
Well, Eliza, one of the reasons I wanted to take your phone call is our first guest on the show, David Figlio from Northwestern. He's done a lot of research directly on that, and we've tweeted out links to some of his research today. You might want to check that out because he goes into pretty serious detail about that very question that you're asking. Hopefully you can check it out.
Yeah, I was listening to him earlier, and I heard the idea about teachers. And I mean, I was a student teacher for a period, and just I think it's crazy to think that teachers don't have some kind of preconceived notion based off of the names that they're reading on the paper, whether it's about the child or about the parent that they might have to deal with throughout the school year.
Eliza, thank you very much. And like I said, check out some of that research because I think you'll find some interesting stuff in there. I want to get to one more quick phone call here from Donna in Windsor before we run out of time. Go ahead, Donna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I named my son Joseph after my grandfather, who was already passed when he came along, but I used the F at the end instead of the PH, so it's a little bit closer to, you know, something unique for him, but I just like the way it looked, and also we have a Hungarian background, and that's probably how they would spell it in Hungary. And also, what I've gotten over the years for him, mail coming for him, they will do Jose F. Palla, and P-A-L-L-A is his last name, so it would be like a Spanish name, Jose F. Palla.
Donna, thank you so much for that. One of the reasons I wanted to get to Donna's call with you, Steve Manning, is what we heard from a lot of people about naming their kids or the names that they got is their names are meaningful in some way. Their personal names are meaningful. They draw some reference to their culture or their family. Does that matter when you're naming a company, you're helping someone name their company? Should it mean something to them, or from a market standpoint, does that not really matter at all?
It's when you're naming a company, it's more important that it means something to your audience. When you're naming a child, it's different.
Okay.
You know, that's personal. But when it's business, it doesn't really matter if it means something to you. It's got to mean something to the audience that you're selling to.
Steve Manning is managing director of Igor. It's a California-based naming company. Steve, before I let you go, is there one favorite name that you helped to come up with, one that you're always very, very proud of?
Oh, there are so many of them. GoGo, the in-flight internet service, Aria, the Las Vegas hotel, to simple things like renaming Court TV to True TV.
Ah, that was a pretty good one. I didn't know that you did that.
Oh, yes.
Very, 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 very good. Steve Manning, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to end with a tweet here from Chris Brown. He says, I wish to claim seniority on my name and force a certain belligerent R&B star to change his. You can keep the tweets coming at Where We Live. You can also email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives with Heather Brandon, Betsy Kaplan, and Samaya Hernandez. The senior producer is Katie Solarski. Thanks to Jules Lefebvre and Emily Boucher, who produced today's program. Thank you, Emily. This is Where We Live.